Hello, everyone. It's 8:31. Rabbi Kelman is coming in a little while, so I'm starting. It's November 6th, 2023. Let us begin. Today will be a very important class because we're going to begin in a few minutes with the great dispute over Auschwitz, Orthodox separatism. It was a dispute that split German Orthodoxy until the war. And it continues today. I have to say it's very relevant. In the talk, I usually mention that in speaking about, we're going to take the story to the present day, that it is very relevant. And so, for instance, I point out that in 2002, obviously the Haredi community is really follows in a certain respect the Auschwitz approach, although it's not exact because we don't have kehillahs. But I've given a lecture on this probably 40 times, and I always mention that I think it was 2002. Remember when there were terrorist attacks going on all the time? There was this huge rally in Washington, D.C., and there was enormous pressure. I was told from someone on the inside that it was on the Aguda. This is, the Litvish yeshivish, that they have to go to Washington. And there was serious discussion, I was told, in the Muetzes. And in the end, the Aguda did not go, although individuals went, but the organization itself never put out a call for people to go. And it just shows you the problem at the Aguda that if unless they can control all the speakers, unless they control everything, they can't give their people the go ahead. And I was thinking about that because there's a huge rally taking place in another week or so in Washington. And we hope it'll have, look, at the end of the day, this is a war, above all, this is a war of propaganda. And it could be that our side is losing this war. So it's important to have a very, very strong showing. And I have to say, look, it would be a pleasant surprise, and I would be thrilled if you saw a whole sea of black and, white, yeshivish people. But just looking at in the past what has happened, it doesn't seem to me that that's going to happen. And the
Bill,
Hasidim,
I entered
forget
your
it.
meeting
The
ID
Hasidim, but I
followed
hope it
by pound.
happens. What? Hold on, hold on to the end. And Hasidim have never participated in this sort of thing. So all I can say is that I hope that all this Auschwitz and everything, because as I'll explain to you, during the Nazi years, the Frankfurt community was finally convinced to give up this Auschwitz, because in dealing with Hitler, you can't have a separatist agenda, in such a situation. So that's just my, if any, we have any people with any influence here, that Jews are being slaughtered and the propaganda war. And I mean, a Jew was killed in Los Angeles. You're going to see it on the news. Just came across the wires about a half hour ago at a P Palestinian protest. They hit him with a megaphone or something and he died. So as I said last week, we're so close from bloodshed in our country. We've seen in other countries. So we need to stand together, like the Nitziv says, which I'll tell you soon, that I mentioned it already and we'll see it again, that when we and really at the end of the day, we should be more influenced by the Nitziv. The Torah community, the Lithuanian community should be more influenced by the Nitziv than any other things I'm going to talk about. That we fight among ourselves, but when facing the outside world, we have to go as a community. And look, I just hope, but I knowing the past, I'm not so I love to be proven wrong and that something changes from 2002. Actually, the situation today is much more dangerous than 2002. Okay, just announce that I'll announce this, and you'll get an email about it. I will not be here next Monday night, so we will meet, God willing, in 2 weeks. Thank you, Moshe, for sending me the text before I had a chance to look at it. I mentioned Rav Yaakov Ettlinger's very strange position. Turns out it's not a position. He raises it, but in the end, he doesn't hold of it when it comes to the Dalet Minyan. He asks the following. He says that we know you have to hold the Dalet Minyan the way they grow. So he says that if an Esrog, let's say, is growing in Argentina and you bring it to the northern hemisphere, then since it's upside down in the southern hemisphere, when you hold it up in the northern hemisphere, it's actually facing the wrong direction. That's what he wondered, how you, if it's, you could use a Dalin meaning that, like an Esrog, for instance, because the Pictum was the different direction in the south. But it, the whole thing, as far as I'm concerned, doesn't make sense because, at the end of the day, everyone's feet is on the ground and the head is in the air. So in the end, he himself said, doesn't accept this in the end, but he raises it as a real problem. And the other post scheme who deal with this, they find it hard to understand what he's going on about with this, but it's quite interesting. If you want to see it, it's in his Bikurei Yaakov. Okay. And a few people asked, oh, about Rabbi Zalman Bear. So as far as I know, he wasn't a rabbi. Here is his picture. We mentioned him. I think maybe people were not aware of who he was. Zelman Bear, he wrote the Siddur, the Avodas Yisrael Siddur. It's a classic, great Siddur. I said mistakenly, I said it was printed in Eastern Europe. It wasn't. It was printed in Frankfurt, in Rödelheim, which is a district in Frankfurt. But anyone who wants to study about the Siddur has to look at the Avodas Yisrael Siddur, and he wrote other things as well. The last thing I want to mention before we get jump in on everything has to do with Tallis, because a number of people were interested in this. So let me go back to what I said. The issue is the stripes. And the tradition is that the stripes are blue. And I mentioned a bit of a problem because the people who discuss it refer to the stripes as being near the edge, the stripe as near the edge, but we have it in the middle. And I mentioned the theory first, as far as I know, first stated. Well, actually, I don't know if it's first stated, but it's stated by Professor Sperber and then in his article by Tsiron, that this comes from the outfit of the Romans, the togas, the high society. And we know Jews did have stripes on their garments. We discovered in the Bar Kokhba excavations, they have clothes of the Jews with stripes. Of course, this is not an explanation that would ever be given by a traditional authority. The Trumas Hadeshen says that the reason for the stripe is that it's blue is memory of Tcheles. So Sviron says so, but that only explains why there's the Tcheles color. It doesn't explain why it's a stripe. Maybe it could be a circle or anything like that. And what I said last class was that when I said there's no evidence, maybe this is the explanation for it. But here's the problem that you have to assume that Jews who were wearing certain clothes in Roman times, that they continued wearing the same clothes throughout all the Babylonian exiles in the Sephardic lands. And we don't have evidence that they did this. And remember, the tallis is a garment. They didn't have a tallis for davening. They wore the tallis all day. And it had tzitzis on in the days of the Gemara. So you ask me, how do I know that they wore it? Maybe they just put it on. Well, let me show you explicit, as we're saying, yeshivas, Beferish and Gemara. Two of them, actually. Oh, no, here. This is in Menachos, 41a. It has a story of an angel who found Rav Katina when he was wearing a linen cloak, which is exempt from ritual fringes. He said to him, Katina, if you wear a linen cloak in the summer and a coat, which only has two corners, in the winter, then what about the tzitzis? So you see that they had this garb that they would wear all the time. It's not speaking about Talos Katan here. It's speaking about the garb they would wear, which the Ammonites continued wearing until modern times, a garb that they would wear around them. What happened was when you get to, let's say, medieval times, that's the assumption of medieval times, when they were no longer wearing clothes with dalet kanfos, four corners, then they started wearing a dalet kanfos Talos Katan underneath. So you'd have it on all the time. And especially for davening, you'd put on a garment which had the tzitzis on it. But until then, they always wore that garment. Now, if you look in Shabbos 147a, what does it say? It says that if you shake your cloak on Shabbos to remove dust, you're liable for a sin offering. But then it goes on. We only stated this with regard to black garments. But with regard to white or red, we have no problem. So here you see that they would be wearing, black garments. So there's nothing here. I mean, just a black clothes. So you say it's a black garment with stripes. Gemara speaks about them wearing a black outer garment. And in Yemen, you should know that that was the tallis, at least on Shabbos. It was a black garment. It was black, totally black. During the weekday, Rav Kafech, in his book, Halichos Teiman, says during the weekday, there were, this is in a section of the book, Malbushim v'Tachshitim. There were two, well, first of all, they had three types of talesim. And one of them was actually, it was brown, and it had a little, it did have not stripes, but like little thin, like gold things on it. So no stripes in Yemen. And on Shabbos, it would be all black. And then there's, during the weekday, there'd be, well, maybe little stripes, I guess he calls it. And then you had the Shabbos, as I said, was completely black, the traditional one. And let's see. And then he had another type of talis. I have it here. Hold on. I can't find exactly where Kafach, but I wrote it down. Hold on. Wait. Something like that. All right, so one talis, which was just, they all wore just black on Shabbos. And in there, during the week, there's two types of talises. One had very thin, like I said, stripes, which it could be, let's say, white or brown. And I can show you pictures of all these, actually. They're online, some of the pictures. And then there's another one, which is just a brown talus. So Yemen, which preserved really very much traditions without adapting them, they never had these stripes that we think about. So the point that this idea that, that people were wearing, why would people be wearing in Babylonia in the 5th century something that people wore 500 years before in Rome? I mean, the outer garment. It's hard for me to accept that. I think the Truma Sedeshan's answer that they wanted to, they wanted to have the tchela, so they made a stripe. Just that there's no evidence that I see that it really comes from Rome. Now, Rav Mazuz points out something interesting, that if you look in the Gemara, talis is a feminine word, as you'd expect it to be feminine. And yet, by the time you get to, so for example, just you have in Chulin, he cites talis sheula patura min tzitzis. But by the time you get to the medieval period, it's called talis gadol, the talis katan. And he says that's because in the medieval period, Ibn Tibbon mentions this in his introduction to the Morning Vuchim, it became popular to treat words that had a tough ending, to treat them as masculine. So that's how we know, by the way, that this whole idea of a talus gadol is medieval, because they referred to it as medieval. If it existed earlier, it would be feminine. That's what Rav Mazuz says. Okay, enough for the talesi. By the way, we're dealing with Germany, so there's rules in Germany about who could wear the talus over the head, even in Pressburg, which is it's not Germany, but it follows German minhagim. Only the Rav and the Dayanim could wear the talus over their head. There was all sorts of strict rules about this. We spoke a little last class about wrapping of talus as well, but right now I want to turn back to the great Rav Zalman Ber Yitzhak Dov. In Germany, they would give him two names. You have the whole, the secular, as it were, name, and then you had the Hebrew name. You'd be called up Torah one, but you'd be referred to as another, and this was a big deal. This was really part of the religious life to give him this name. If you recall, last class we were in the middle of discussing the question of the children of the Würzburger Rav, Rav Zalman Ber Bamberger. He left his tshuvos. He didn't want to publish his responsa. He thought that his halachic works he wrote were at the high level. People could rely on them. But the responsa he wrote, they weren't at such a high level. And he didn't want people to rely on them. So the question is, do we need to listen to what Abba said that not to publish them? And the first question went in the Tziv, and I did an introduction about it. So I want to pick up in the letters of the Tziv. It's also in the Tshuvos of the Tziv. If you have the letters, it's page 191. He says, he says, The Nitziv says, I don't agree with your father's position. We already saw he last class, he didn't agree with this notion that the responds are on a lower level than practical, than halachic writings, like just writings of psukim, like we have, for example, you have halachic works like the Rush, his volume of halachot, versus the Tshuvot. And he also says that he doesn't agree with this idea that your father has control of his halachic works, that if he says, you know, bury them or destroy them, I don't think so. Well, what does the Nitziv say? The Torah is only, obviously, it's your Torah in a certain sense. If I write a tshuva, no one else can publish it if I'm going to publish it. If I published a sefer, then I have the rights to reprint the sefer. No one else can come and say, well, it's not your Torah. It is my Torah. And no one can plagiarize and steal my Torah and go around. It's mine. However, that's only the case if you use it in this world. Masha inkein im ba'avdo min olam, the Nitziv says. However, this is not your Torah to the extent that you own it like you own your shirt. And that you can destroy it. It's not said this Torah has been given to you. God has granted you the ability to have this, and it's yours as long as you use it. However, to destroy it, then it says you don't have the, it's not under your control, which it's interesting because obviously if Rizal Mimber was alive, you'd think that he could burn it, but after his death he can't. But instead of saying you don't even have the right in your lifetime to destroy it, that's he says v'hare mitzvah min ha-Torah lomod atzmo lomed acherim. There's a mitzvah not just to learn, but if you can, to teach others. And he says that this inyan that he's speaking about is like truma, the kedusha of truma. We know truma, it has to be given to the kohen, right? It's yours, it's your food, it's your fruit. You can give it, he says, the whole Kohen Shayirtse. You can give it to whatever Kohen you want to give it to. But you can't destroy it. In other words, so it's my Torah. I can decide if I want to give a shear here or give a shear there, but I can't not give the shear if there are people who are willing to listen and I have what to share. Certainly, you can't destroy it so other people can. And he says it's like Truma. You can decide. It's like Tzedakah. You can decide which tzedakah you want to give to, but you can't say, I'm not going to give to tzedakah. I think it's a bit of a chiddush to say, which is the implication that even the Rav Zalman Bear couldn't destroy it. But that seems to be what, obviously the children can't destroy it, but he's saying that the Torah is only yours if you use it, and for the purposes we speak of, Masha ain't keeping the lavdo min olam. But you don't have the right to destroy it, just like you don't have the right to destroy Truma. Very interesting. And then he goes on, the Kedusha of the Torah, Afagaf the Nikres al Shmo Shel Machadesh. Look, if the Torah is in your name, if you come up with a great Chiddush, we apply it to your name, and you're given the credit, and we say it's your Torah. And they want to say it's your nachla, nachla so. But that's only, he says again, it's only if it's, you know, you're using the Torah. But about in rotzesh yunevadim in olam ze ein lo rishus. But it doesn't apply if you're trying to get rid of it. So your father, he says to the sons, he doesn't have the authority to get rid of it. And now that he hasn't gotten rid of it, you certainly don't have the authority. You need to publish it because he says that your father was such a gon and such a tzaddik, and we need this Torah that he wrote, and it's going to be a benefit for us. And then he says, it's true that we've lost many responsa and much Torah from great Torah sages over the generations, going all the way back to the Gaonic period and before. And he says this is because they didn't merit from heaven that their Torah should be learnt ledoros. That is, not everyone who wrote a tshuva does he merit from heaven that it's published, and published in preprinting times means that copyists copy it and send it out, and that it should therefore be studied for everyone. This is the old question that the Chazon Ish was very hesitant about works like the Me'iri. Because if they weren't, he saw the transmission, the Mesorah, as sort of divinely guided. And if you have works like the Meiri or other responsa, which were not part of the transmission, then just to bring them and publish them now, and now we're going to start changing the way we do halakha, he opposed that. I think the Chazon Ish's position has really become a minority position because they're publishing things all the time. But the Netziv says, I would say he's in line with the Chazon Ish, because he says that many tshuvot were lost, and therefore they're not for Ledorot, the part of the halachic tradition. Now, what he thinks are lost, many of them really weren't lost. They just were kept in some library somewhere. So before the last, 50 years, the explosion of printing, for all practical purposes, they were lost. And he says that the Gemara mentions that there are many Nevi'im. It's in the Gemara Megillah. Who lo zachu shenem rumid vulos on ledoros, that they gave there are lots of Nevi'im. It isn't just the ones that we have. There's other Nevi'im, but and some of them are even mentioned in earlier sources, and even ones we know. Eliyahu. I mean, he's a prophet, but what did Eliyahu say? Where are his prophecies? I mean, we don't have his prophecies. He obviously spoke all sorts of matters, just like Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu, but we don't have that. We just have, story of his life, Elisha. So that doesn't mean that they were not valuable and important people, but not everything remains. But he says, and also he says, Tanayim and Amarayim. We don't know their positions. They weren't recorded in the Mishnah and the Gemara. But this happened through divine providence. It just happened, but we're not in control of it. No Amora ever said that my position shouldn't be there, or no Navi ever said that my prophecy shouldn't be preserved, and no medieval rabbi said my tshuva shouldn't be preserved, but that's how it happened. You want to say Hashkacha Pratis, through just the vagaries of time, whatever you want to say, it's not here. So that's the way it is. However, She'adam Mitzavah, but to have a person who will command Rabbeid Sarasav Engel Koach, but no one has the authority, even a great Gadol B'Yisrael, no one has the authority to say, I'm going to destroy my Torah. Because if it's real Torah, and it is real Torah, he wrote Shuvas, if it's real Torah, then it's yours to the extent that your name is on it to give it authority, but not to destroy it. Once you're it, that you don't have the authority to. God didn't give you the koach, the ability to write these responsa, then to destroy it. And he says, if God doesn't want, if God doesn't want these tshuvos to appear in print, harbe drachim lafanav, that there are many ways. There could have been a fire, and all we've had many examples where tshuvos were burnt, and other svarim were burnt in fires. There used to be a lot of fires because everything was made of wood. The fact that the tshuvos are still around shows that God wants them to be published, and if He wants to destroy it, then God can do that. But we cannot destroy it, and that's halacha l'maisa. And He's telling him, you need to publish it. I'll tell you something I mentioned the other day, because someone asked me about the so-called minor prophets. We have all these minor prophets. You could even have one, Ovadia has one chapter, and Malachi has what, three, I think. They're minor because, not because they're insignificant people, they're minor because the books are small. That's why we call them minor. It's like if you have a piece of paper. Let's say before computers and everything, you can make PDFs. You have a piece of paper. You have a book. It's on your shelf. Well, let's say, what do you do if you have a piece of paper? Just one piece of paper. How are you going to keep track of it? You're going to lose it. So, you have to make a binder and stick in it. That's what the treyas are, the minor prophets. They're put together in this volume. We call them the minor prophets because they have to be together, like in one big Megillah, let's say, and put them all together. Otherwise, they'd be lost. But do we think that Malachi, that Ovadia only didn't have more chapters? Sure, they had other prophecies. Ovadia, he had more to say, too. They each had a lot to say, but it wasn't preserved. What we have is what we have. So that's his tshuva. He concludes, absolutely, you can't destroy it. However, he then does add one caveat, which is interesting. He says that Well, first of all, he says, you asked me to look at the chuvos before we publish them. He says, I can't look at them. He says, my haskama is not male umorid. It doesn't, everyone knows how great your father was. You're asking me? The sons asked, before we publish it, why don't you look at the chuvos, the nitziv, and tell us if you think it's worthy of publish? And he says, I'm not going to do that. You know, okay, but then he says, and this is interesting, he sort of backtracks a little. And I wonder if this final paragraph takes away takes away some of his, really strong points here. He says that, however, since you've mentioned that your father was worried, you know, to put out his chuvot, which are halacha ledoros, eternal rulings, because he didn't know if other people would agree with him, he says you should give it to one of the gedolim or a few gedolim that they should look at it before you publish it. And if they find something which is problematic, that is, they find something which they don't agree with, Tov Yosef Hashmita. When it says, okay, this you can leave out. That is, we're not going to say leave out the entire book, but, you know, get rid of the entire book, but give all the tshuvot. If the other gedolim finds something, like he comes up with a big kuwa, something which isn't accepted, that you can leave out, and it's not kedai to print this tshuva. So, look, is this censorship? I wrote a whole book on censorship, and I even spoke about censorship of manuscripts. I don't think so. I don't think this is a sort of censorship I spoke about, because remember, at the end of the day, Bamberger didn't want any of the tshuvas published. So here the Nitziv is saying, you know, have the other Rabbonim look at it. If there's something that's really way out there and they think the conclusion is really totally unsupported, okay, so don't publish that. But this is in line with what Bamberger wanted. What I wrote about was something different, where the rabbis wrote the Sfarim and left the tshuvos intending to publish them. But the later generations, because they found something problematic, decided to censor it, or even worse, when the book was published the first time, and the second time around, they decide to censor things, remove tshuvot, which the original author published. But that's not the case here, although the Nitziv definitely leaves open an option that that there could be some response. I don't know if in the end any were taken out. There's no record of any taken out. And it would be hard to imagine that Rabbonim in the generation really after a Bamberger, or younger, even if he's the same generation, but younger, would feel comfortable saying that the Torah, it's like giving rabbis today a Chuvas or a Moshe Feinstein. And they say, well, no, this shouldn't be published. This should be published. Like, who are they're going to decide which Chuva is good enough to appear in print? It's hard to see it. Now, we have one other letter which comes to the same conclusion. And that was the other Gadol HaDor, although they say they asked three. They say they asked the Nitziv, that is the sons, Rav Yisrael Inspector, and Rav Diskin from Brisk. Look, if they say they asked them, I agree, they asked them. The problem is that in summarizing what Rav Diskin says and Rav Yitzhak Hanan, they only say what Rav Yitzhak Hanan says. And they say, we don't have the tshuva Rav Diskin wrote. So I wonder if Rav Diskin gave a verbal answer and didn't really write a tshuva, because the summary they give is exactly what Rav Yitzhak Hanan. What does Rav Yitzhak Hanan say? You can find it in the introduction to another volume of Bamberger's, Rav Simcha Bamberger, one of the sons, called Zecher Simcha. In the introduction, he has the whole tshuva of the Nitziv, and the Nitziv says, again, he raises the question, your father didn't want to publish it, so what to do? And if you do publish it, maybe you're going against the words of your father, and so you've asked me the question. And he says that this isn't an uncommon thing. The Reitz Ochanan says that the Shach, in the introduction to his commentary in Yerodea, says that no one should rely on what I wrote, basically, unless you examine it or ask other people. Okay, but the Shach published it. He just said not to rely on it. Rav Bamberger was saying don't publish it at all. And then the Yitzchak Aharon quotes the Pri Megadim at the beginning of Hilchos Pesach. He says also, anyone who studies this, don't rely on what I said. I'm just trying to, just on me, I'm just trying to raise the issues. You have to investigate it yourself. Again, I don't see the parallel. Rabbi Bamberger didn't want to publish it at all. They could have published it and simply said, don't rely on it. There's a section of the Tshuvas of Rav Ettlinger in his Binyan Sion, which the section begins with a note from the son saying these tshuvot are not, are halacha v'lo maisa, are not practical. Now, we don't know whether the father actually told the son that or the son said it. In fact, the first tshuva that comes after that, I recall it's the first, not the second, is the famous Binyan Sion about a Shabbos violator. Does he make wine not kosher? Basically, can he count him in a minion, all these things, and the Binyan Sion, the famous tshuva, is that today Shabbos violators are different in the past because, look, they go to shul Friday night, they have kiddush, it's l'tayavon they're doing it. They don't oppose Shabbos. The reason we Shabbos violator was regarded as out of the fold is because he's regarded as a complete heretic. He rejected creation, all that. The Binyan Sion says today we see that's not the case. The people we see want to be involved, but for whatever reason, they're not completely observant like we have today. You have plenty of people, maybe not most Orthodox shuls, it used to be many Orthodox shuls, but if you leave the New York area, you definitely have plenty of Orthodox shuls where you have the non-observant Orthodox. People go every Shabbos, but sometimes they drive. Many don't drive, but they'll walk, but at home they'll turn on lights. We all know that type. These are not people who reject for whatever reason. They're not completely observant, but they're the non-observant or not completely observant Orthodox. And that tshuva, the Binyan Sion, even though he says halacha vo amaisa, everyone relies on it amaisa. Well, how can you do that? Well, the Sadeh Chemed has a whole section dealing with this. When people modestly say, Rabbanim, say that here is the tshuva, but don't rely on it, maybe, do we hold that really we don't rely on them? Or is this just because of their modesty they're saying that? And plenty of authorities say that even if the Posek says, don't rely on what I'm saying, the fact that he published the tshuva and put it out there, We follow the tshuva and we don't follow his words of modesty because he's just being modest. And at the end of the day, he still has authority. That's the mainstream view, that even when these gedolim say, don't rely on me, we still rely on them. And so what does the Netziv say, the Reitz Elchanan say? He says, my suggestion is that when you publish the responsa, just write in the introduction that Rav Bamberger didn't want people to rely halacha amaisa until they examine it themselves. So another Rav who sees it shouldn't just rely on Rav Bamberger says without himself going in and investigating the matter. And he says you should publish it and you should be mezaka, bring merit to everyone who's going to study them. And the same sort of thing. That, although he doesn't get into the whole issue of does your father own the Torah? Rav Yitzchak Aharon simply says, just put it in the front that no one should rely on it, and with that you're fulfilling what your father wanted. Because at the end of the day, he didn't want people to rely on it. I don't know if you're fulfilling what he wanted. Rav Bamberger also could have published it, and he also could have said, publish it. And just say no one should rely on it. He didn't want it to be published. I think the Netziv is more accurate in what he's saying. And the Netziv's whole point is amazing. It's an amazing chiddush that even Gadol Yisrael, they're given a gift from God, from Kodesh Baruch Hu. And but when they're through their combination of Siyata Deshmaya and learning, are able to come up with new Torah halacha, it doesn't only belong to them. It belongs to Kol Yisrael. It belongs to them if they use it, but they don't have the right to get rid of it totally. The Reitz Elchanan doesn't say that. He just assumes that there's no problem. He makes a parallel between what Rav Bamberger says and what all these other rabbanim say. Don't rely on me unless you investigate it. So, okay. Now we're going to turn to a big issue that's going to keep us for a few weeks. A very important issue. It's an issue that comes to America, Hungary. We'll deal with Hungary as well. And that's the issue of how orthodox. We use this term orthodox. Hirsch never liked the term orthodox, but Torah true, let's say. Even in German, Torah true doesn't mean what we say Torah true. It means like faithful to the Torah. But let's say Shomrei Torah mitzvos. What is the relationship in an organized communal sense between observant Jews and community as well, our kehillah, and the non-Orthodox kehillot? Should there be a, or should there not be? Obviously, this is an issue that can only come up in modern times when you have non-Orthodox kehillahs. Yes, we had irreligious individuals, but the kehillah was observant. Do you want to know how the Jewish kehillah was? Think, look at the Sephardic world. There was only a religious kehillah. Not everyone's religious. And when you come to the 20th century in North Africa, you have plenty of people who weren't religious at all, really, but they understood that, this is Judaism. I might not follow it, but this is the religion. So that's not really a problem. The problem is when you have organized communities of reform, and then later we called the positive historical school, and especially in Germany, because Germany had a system where all Jews were in one community. You couldn't leave this community unless you said that you were an atheist or became a Christian, and you had to pay taxes. And your tax money went, of course, to support all the communal institutions, the shul. Often there was a Jewish hospital, an old age home, the mikveh, all these things. Not a problem. In fact, that's a great idea. We don't have this in America, the idea of a kehillah. If this were, we had this in America, then the idea that once your kids, look, when our kids are out of school, it's like it's a big relief off us. But if you were in a real community, everyone has to support the school and all these institutions. So that's how traditional communities functioned. Oh, but what happens now in the 19th century when all of a sudden you have the community is controlled by the reform and they have a synagogue. They build a big temple. Or often they didn't build it. They just took over the old traditional shul. So now your tax money is going to support non-Orthodox institutions. It's supporting heretical institutions, supporting institutions preaching against observance of Torah. Are you allowed to do that? Now, you really didn't have a choice because it was the law. So one of the issues is, should you try to change the law? And once the law is changed, and we're going to go through all this, are you then obligated to leave this community? And then it gets into other issues because leaving aside the situation in Germany, you have in Israel, you have in America, even if you don't have a kehillah like we're going to see you have in Germany, you have larger questions. Can Orthodox communities be involved, let's say, in federation? Can Orthodox rabbis, we're going to get to the issue of Synagogue Council of America. Can, for the greater good, can we get together? Can we coordinate and get together and go to Washington, D.C. to speak out strongly in support of Israel and in opposition to the anti-Semites when it means that the Orthodox rabbi is going to speak and then the Reform rabbi is going to speak and we're all doing it together. We saw Rav Soloveitchik's opinion that in situations like this, yes, we are together, but does everyone believe this? So before we go into all these details, we have to see the background and the history, and it's an amazing history. It's a really interesting history, and it's been written by a number of people, and it leads, unfortunately, as we'll see, to a terrible dispute between two of the great sages of Germany, Rabbi Bamberger and Rabbi Hirsch. And okay, look, it's history. We can't cover it up, but it's not pleasant, and the wounds. I think the wounds. People can correct me if I'm wrong. I think the wounds have pretty much all healed by now, but the wounds were very sharp and very bitter, and it continued until World War II to the extent, well, to the extent that some people would not go into the other shul, things like that. But we'll get to that. Okay, I begin by stating that just to take it off the table from the beginning, and then we'll go into details. Often in popular writing and in scholarly writing, you have a description of a dispute between the great Rabbiner Hirsch and Rabbiner Bamberger, that Bamberger is the one in opposition to separatism, who believes in staying in one community with the reform in the name of the greater good of the, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing could be further from the truth. Bamberger was himself an advocate of separatism, of separating from the reformers, on a number of occasions. The situation that we're going to deal with now in Frankfurt was Let's say the Orthodox are given everything they need to have a complete Torah life. In such a case, and I'll describe the details, do you still need to separate? That is it an absolute in all circumstances? But so, for example, in 1872, a number of rabbanim, in fact, about 400 rabbanim in Hungary and in Germany, I think also in Russia, gave a ruling that members of the Kehillah in Vienna were forbidden to remain part of it, since the Kehillah in Vienna had introduced reforms contrary to the Torah. So I can't remember now whether legally they could separate, but what it means is they have to open up their own shul. This became known as the shift shul. And son-in-law, the Chasam Sofer, became the first Rav. In other words, even if legally you can't separate, and that's going to be the situation for a number of years in Frankfurt, that doesn't mean you still can say you can't go to the shul, the so-called Orthodox shul, because at the end of the day, the Orthodox shul is controlled by the Reform leadership of the community. They're the ones that fund it, and they're the Yoshev Rosh over it. So you have to do everything you can to separate yourself from that.
This
well,
is called Austrit, right?
Yes, Austrit, exactly. Guess who signed this letter? And among the German rabbis, guess who was, I would say, the most distinguished as the halachic authority to sign this letter about the Jews in Vienna? None other than Rav Zalman Ber Bamberger. So he was not a believer in unity for the sake of unity. Very strict rules had to be followed, and tana'im, and conditions. But as we'll see, those were followed in Frankfurt, and that's what led to the dispute. So let's just take this off the table to begin with, that this idea that Bamberger is some, like, when it comes to unity, he's some liberal modern Orthodox rabbi who has no problem, you know, being on all these different interdenominational groups. That's not Bamberger at all. It's precisely because Bamberger had shown himself to support Austrit in other circumstances that the assumption was of Hirsch's followers that Bamberger would support Hirsch. And that's not what happened. So let's look in detail. In fact, I'll repeat this, but I'll just anticipate the great dispute, which happens. Bamberger comes to Frankfurt. I'll describe it. Then rules against Hirsch. He was invited to come to Frankfurt by Hirsch's followers, because they assumed he would rule in favor of Hirsch. Okay. Now, there are two major aspects, I think, to Hirsch's philosophy. I think we got to do classes on Hirsch, because I did 2007. I think I did this as one class. There's the two major aspects which he was dedicated to, devoted his life to. One is Torim Derech Eretz. This is going to have relevance to the dispute also. Torim Derech Eretz, Torah and Western civilization, the best of the Western, of whatever civilization you are. Torah obviously has to be the controlling factor, but there's wisdom in the world, and we don't want to push ourselves away from that. This is, I mean, he writes about this as early as the 19 letters, how we were put in the ghetto against our will, and that's not where we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be in the world and influencing it for good. It's not just the reformers that use the word mission. Hirsch also spoke about a mission. And, the greatest Kiddush Hashem is a religious doctor, a lawyer, a government worker, you know, be involved in society. Yeah. Is it hard? Yeah, it's hard, but that's being a Torah Jew is hard, and that's what you have to do. This whole philosophy of Torah Derech Eretz. The other major aspect of his philosophy is what we know as Austrit, well, separatism, stepping out, you know, not being part of the reform dominated community. This is not mentioned in the 19 letters. It's not clear when he came to see this as so central. Whether only after he comes to Frankfurt, which I'll describe in a few minutes, or even before. But these are the two major aspects of his philosophy. And Austrit, as I said, only once he comes to Frankfurt does he speak about it. Now, in Germany, the law was that if you were Jewish, if you declared your religion Jewish, you had to pay taxes to the Jewish community. And then the taxes would be used, or actually for a time it used to be pay taxes to the community. Later on, it became you pay taxes to the government, and the government then puts that amount back to the community. And that's what you even have today in Germany. These taxes, as I said, would support the various communal institutions, pay the rabbi's salary, the chazan, all this. And this is the kehillah structure that is basically not found anywhere except maybe you could argue in Israel. Because in Israel, everyone pays taxes and then money goes to support Jewish institutions. So I guess that's sort of like the kehillah. And okay, as I said, this sounds very nice, but the problems begin in the 19th century when reform becomes popular. And how can an Orthodox Jew, that's what the term that they started calling them, how can an Orthodox Jew give money that's supporting a non-Orthodox institution? So now when really this is only an issue when the halachic issue, a pure halachic issue, when the Orthodox are a majority. If the Orthodox are a minority, then your money is not supporting the reform institutions. Your money is coming back and supporting your institutions, and reform money is probably coming to support your institutions. But if you're the majority, let's say you're in a small town and you want to open a reform temple, obviously it's a problem because you're the majority. Your money is definitely going because you're the majority. So after supporting all the communal institutions, your money is probably going to go to support the non-Orthodox institutions. But leaving aside the pure halachic angle of money supporting non-Orthodox institutions, you have the larger question. Can you be connected officially in a community where you all vote and you pay taxes, you're in like one family with people who want to uproot everything that you think is holy? The fact that you're at the table with them gives them a legitimacy. You're recognizing them. And you say, well, I'm not recognizing them. Well, but the fact that you're with them shows that you're in one community. You're not in another community. And is this permissible? Now, the origins of all this are in Frankfurt. And by the time you get to the 19th century in Frankfurt, Orthodox Jews are a minority. It's amazing. Within two generations, Orthodox Jews became a minority. How did they become a minority? This is also going to be an important point for Hirsch because, we'll get to it. Now, we know that the general community, which was run by the non-Orthodox, were not treating the Orthodox properly. Now, it's true that the Orthodox didn't treat, if you recall the classes on reform, the Orthodox didn't treat the reform very well either. They tried to shut their temples down. But to his credit, Hirsch opposed this. He said that in modern times, you can't enforce religion. It all has to be for persuasion. So I know you're thinking there's a lot of inconsistency here because the Orthodox are complaining that the reform are not treating them well. When the reform were running the show, they tried to shut the temples down. They went to the government to shut them down. But Hirsch was very opposed to this. Hirsch was absolutely consistent. He did not believe government should get involved in religion, so much so that his great-grandson, Mordechai Breuer, writes an article in Jewish Action in the 90s or the 80s in which he says that if my great-grandfather was alive today, he'd completely oppose the situation in the state of Israel where you have religious coercion, because he said that in modern times, you can only try to convince people. And look, it's a problem in Israel. They try to force it on people and it leads to a backlash and anti-religious. Now, I don't know if Breuer was right, because there could be a difference in a Jewish country and a secular and a secular or non-Jewish country. But that's what Breuer said. What do I mean that the non-Orthodox didn't treat them well? So, for example, they tried to shut down the yeshivas there. They had yeshivas, tried to make it almost impossible for them to learn Torah. Although they did learn Torah, they tried to make it difficult for them. They shut the mikveh. They closed the mikveh in Frankfurt. The women had to go to one of the suburbs. So it was not a good scene. So in response, but Frankfurt still had faithful Jews. They've always had faithful Jews. And they decided, although there was an Orthodox synagogue under the auspices of the general community, there was a group of Jews that said, that's, how can we have an Orthodox synagogue, which the Reform are involved with, and control the money, control everything? So they said, we will create our own community. Now, they couldn't legally open up a community, namely where you tax, remember, tax money. You couldn't legally have it where tax money would go to this community because you only had one community recognized by the government. The government recognized Protestant communities, Jewish communities, and Catholic communities. That's it. No two Jewish communities. The Protestant were Lutherans. You didn't have all the other communities either. That's it. So what this meant was that they'd have to pay double taxation. That is, we're going to open up our own shul here, and we're going to have to support it with our money, and we're also going to have to continue paying taxes to the larger community. And they did, which shows you how committed they were to this. In fact, I called it a community. It was a community, but they couldn't even legally refer to it as a community because another community was not allowed. So instead, they called it a Gesellschaft, which means a society. And really, you couldn't have a rabbi because you didn't have a community. You could have a preacher or something like that. But really, this is a community, and it is a synagogue that they were creating, even if they didn't use that language at first. And then they needed a rabbi. And who was this rabbi going to be? None other than Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. And Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch doesn't become famous in Frankfurt. Again, a common misconception. He already is pretty famous. He's chief rabbi of Moravia. He's in Nikolsburg, and there's loads of communities. I forget the exact number under him. It's an important position in Moravia, but he was not very happy there. There were problems he was having. He was looking for a new challenge, let's say. So after being there a number of years, he gets the call from this, I guess you want to call it a small breakaway minion. And it's amazing that the big rabbi, the leader of this great rabbi, decides to leave his community in Nikolsburg and all the environs. If we go to Central Europe this summer, that's the plan. I'll show you his house. And we go to Nikolsburg. So many Gedolei Yisrael there, but Hirsch is also there. I mean, you have the Maharal and Maharal Bennett and so many, many Gedolei. But you also have Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. And if you're Rav in Nikolsburg, you're rabbi of the whole region in Moravia. And he's willing to give that up to go to a breakaway minion in Frankfurt. When he agrees to come, the machers, they make all these deals with him. And in the end, he's committed. He goes. And I think you can say he saw this as a great opportunity to create a Torah society, a Torah in Derech Eretz society, a purist society, not with the compromises of being with the reformers, a voluntary society of committed Jews. And I'm not sure if it was only after he came to Frankfurt or even when he was in Moravia, he came to the conclusion that the only way for a Torah society to function, no matter where it is to separate on a communal level from the non-Orthodox. We're not talking about that you need to, that you as an Orthodox Jew can't have relationships with non-Orthodox. Hirsch himself had a brother who was non-Orthodox. We're not talking about an individual level. We're talking on a communal level that where each side is recognized as equal. It is true. Adam Furziger talks about it in his book, Exclusion and Hierarchy, that there are times that Hirsch seems to move in the direction that even individuals we need to separate from. So, for instance, he quotes the Chasam Sofer, who says that if I had it in my authority, I would ban marriages between the Orthodox and the non-Orthodox. So there are some times where he seems to move in this direction, but the majority, the overwhelming majority, and the way he lived his life, we know that this is an issue of communities, and I guess you'd say non-Orthodox rabbis, but not the Balabatim, not the Hamonam, who even the individual Reformed Jew, as far as Hirsch is concerned, is an unwitting sinner. He doesn't know any better. And our job for them is to try to influence them. I see it's already 9:25, so we're just getting started with this. It's, as I said, it's a fascinating story with a lot of relevance to the contemporary time. And not just the whole American Orthodox history and Hungary, England, the rest. Well, so we'll get into that. But let me see some of the questions. Rabbi Yellen, you said my audio goes in and out? Okay. Others didn't have it, so maybe it was a problem with your internet.
Yeah, it was my problem.
Okay. Susanna says she once asked a sturdy rabbi who people say Talit Katan, not Katana. He needed to look into it before responding, but told me it's because it's in the category of Beged. Again, I don't know what it is, what Beged has to do with anything. If you look in the Gemara refers to it as a feminine. So the question is why in medieval times is it being used masculine? So as Ramazu says, and we know that many feminine words, they started using them in a masculine way. Why? We don't have begeds? We don't refer to them feminine? Well, we do. Talit.
Beged is masculine. The word beged is masculine.
The word, but what does that have to do with talit?
Well, he said
that. I thought you meant every beged is masculine. No, no. If you look, those who want to see it, it's take a look at. Well, actually, another. Rav Mazuz gives a few examples. But this is one we all know, right? Because we learned it what, in fifth grade, sixth grade. Shnai mochzin. What is it? Shnai mochzin betalis. Ze elmer ani matzatia. Right. Ze elmer kula shali. Shein ba pachot. So you see already right there in the Mishnah they're referring to it, and he gives a few other examples in Chulin. Like I said, talit sheula, ptura, and okay. Look, it ends with a tough. So usually we say if it ends with a tough, it's feminine.
Sorry, Rabbi, in the Gemara, talit is a begit. Talit is not a talit. What we call talit katan. At that time, it was just a shirt or a cloth or pants. Talit in the Gemara is begit.
Yes. Okay. Chaim, were you here at the first five minutes?
Yes.
Okay, because that's what I said. That's talit in the Gemara is just they wore a begit. They wore a garb. Yeah. They didn't have it's only when they stopped wearing that garb with four corners that then they said, well, at least in the shul, we'll wear a tzitzis. And that's where you get the talit.
So, but when you're talking about the talit in the Gemara is Bama Metzia, it's really begit.
Yes, it's a beged, but that's the word. That's the same. That's what we do in shul. It's a beged. It just so happens we only wear it during davening.
That's what he says, mitzatia or mitzatihu. That is, you can hear both. You can hear both in the Gemara. It's not something.
No, but the word talit. If you look in the Gemara and the Mishnah, it's treated as a feminine word. That's the point. It's treated as a feminine word.
You take a reference to the word talit mitzatiha, but you can see it sometimes you can refer to the same thing also in a masculine, sometimes in a feminine. We should not learn dikduk from the Lashon HaGemara.
I know, but that's, for example, like I said, talit she'ula p'tura min hatzitzit. We see right there that they treat it as a feminine.
No. You can say Shaul. Talit Shaul. Okay.
No, but you don't. That they don't say it. That's the point. They treat it in the Gemara as a feminine word. Okay. Now, it could be, you can look. There might be some examples where it's masculine. We treat it masculine.
You know,
but
if you're talking about
I didn't have to check the manuscripts. Because it could be that the manuscripts have been corrected in accord with the medieval way of understanding it. But that's the only point I'm making. And then the talit only becomes, it's just a side point. So the main point was that it was only, we think, in medieval times that the whole concept of a talis gadol and a talis katan comes into fashion. There's no talis katan in the Gemara. The Gemara, everyone wore this garb. But we want to wear tzitzis all the time. So when they didn't have dalet konfos on the beged, the large beged, they started wearing a small arba konfos, and then they instituted that at least in shul will wear the big beged, and this wasn't universal. There were some places where people did not wear talis gadol, but by now, of course, it's all universal.
In the time from Yosef, he wore a ktonet, and a ktonet is a feminine.
Yes, okay. You can wear any sort of garb you want, but we now, of course, we're accustomed to do it that way. In
Yes.
Morocco, there were people who did not wear talus. And you had a shawl, and only the rabbi wore a talus, or the tamei chachamim. That was a minhag they had in certain places in Morocco. David says that Rav Ovadia refers to talit in the feminine on the very Gemara Menachos that Mark just quoted. Okay, so he's regarding it as feminine. Okay, but the problem is that we say talis katan. Talit chadasha. Okay, so he's doing it. So I don't know. In modern Hebrew, I assume they also refer to talit as feminine. I don't know. You tell me, David. But look, the fact is that we don't refer to it as feminine. And for 1,000 years in Torah literature, it was masculine. It was never talit katana. It was always talis katan, you know. And so we know that in the Hebrew language, sometimes it goes back and forth between masculine and feminine. Sometimes in Tanakh itself, words are they're unclear. But
Yeah, in
and
modern
David
Hebrew,
also.
everyone says
Yep.
Geulah.
Everyone
Yeah.
says we treat it. We've returned now to the feminine. Okay. David says that the Ramah rules that one should not wear red clothing because it's preetzus stick, and I do not see any discussion in the Gemara that sees a problem. That connecting the Gemara and Menachos that sees no problem with red clothing. Okay, but I. Yeah. Okay, it's a good question. Why does the Gemara mentions red there, which I just read that Gemara. And but red then becomes a an issue. It's certainly an issue for women. You say there's no distinction between men and women. Generally, the poskim speak about women, but you're right. In the early source, it does speak about Shulchan Aruch. It says Malbushim Edomim. Okay, you're right, but it seems for whatever reason it's only a women's issue. Morris Moshe says regarding the right, what right survived, the Zohar statement is appropriate. Yes, Hakotol that's in the Zohar, correct. And although I always wonder, I mean, it's a famous statement. A lot of people don't know it's from the Zohar. What does it mean, Afigo Sefer Torah Shebehecho? What's that refer to? Does that mean
It
that
means,
the
for example, if you have three or four Sefer Torah, yes, and
yeah.
you use one, but one never gets used, or one gets used very little and one gets used a lot. Something like that.
Oh, I thought it might be referring to the it's not referring to the base of Migdash. They kept the three Sifrei Torah there that were supposed to be the ones that they used in case there was disputes. I thought maybe I always thought it was referring to that maybe, but you're right. A Kol Tamazo, even if you're talking of the local Heichal in your shul, which one you
Yeah.
take out. Okay, that makes sense. David says this is her Mordechai Breuer, the Tanakh Sar's cousin. No, there's two Mordechai Breuers. The Tanakh one, who is at Gush, and Reb Mordechai Breuer, and he's Rabbi Mordechai Breuer. And then there's Professor Mordechai Breuer, the son of Isaac Breuer. He's the expert on German Orthodoxy. I've told the story before that there was a conference in memory of Professor Mordechai Breuer a couple of years after he died at Bar-Ilan. I think he died in 2007, 2008. So a couple of years after that, so I went there and I spoke. One of the things, what I spoke about was actually the reception of Hirsch, Storim Derech Eretz, in both the Haredi community and in the followers of Rav Kook. So the whole conference was on was in honor of in memory of Rabbi Breuer, and then one not Rabbi Breuer, sorry, Professor Breuer. And one day his whole family came because they were going to do a session devoted to him. Not, the others were just lectures, but and the conference was in memory of him. So the president at the Bar-Ilan comes to speak, and everyone's there, and the family's there. Family was actually sitting in my row, and the president gets up and gives a whole speech, 10 minutes, about how great the honoree of this conference is, and he's speaking about Rabbi Mordechai Breuer, not professor. And everyone's sitting there and they're chuckling and they're looking one to the other and no one has the heart to say anything. I don't know if afterwards if they told him. Obviously the person in the president's office was told it's a conference for Mordechai Breuer, so he wrote up a whole thing and he's the president's going through all the contributions of Rabbi Breuer, and they died very within a few months of each other. But it was unbelievably embarrassing, and I hope no one ever told him. And Professor Spitzer's on the stage with the president as he's doing this, and everyone's looking around like It was, look, these things happen. He was a chemist, as I recall, or a physicist, wasn't in the humanities, the president. Chaim says that the Rabbi Nathan Bamberger from the Bamberger, I keep saying Bamberger because I'm thinking in America we call it Bamberger, like the supermarket Bamberger, but Bambergers, but it's Bamberger. But that he was married to a member of the Breuer family, and in the 80s, she told us since their wedding, her relatives would no longer speak to her in the 1980s? Okay, well, that's taking it a little too far because the dispute really isn't relevant anymore. There are some interesting switches. So, for instance, one of the great villains of the story we're going to tell from the standpoint of the Breuers is the communal Rav of Frankfurt. His name was Mordechai Horowitz, the Mate Levi. He's a real goon, but they regarded him as a traitor, and they wouldn't, Shlomo Breuer wouldn't stay be in the same room with him. They put his shul in Cherem. So what becomes of Mordechai Breuer's descendants? Well, the Yeshiva Devar Yerushalayim, all Haredi. And what becomes of Hirsch's descendants? At least some of them. I mean, Washington Heights is one thing, but at least some of them are, Mordechai Breuer, Morzioni, Paul Egudis Yisrael, Bar Ilan University. So I was told by one of the descendants of the Mate Levi, who was very yeshivish, that he met Professor Breuer once. Professor Breuer said, it's very ironic that now you're like the more Haredi type and I'm more the more liberal, when in Frankfurt it was just the opposite. It was my forefathers who were the more extreme and you were considered the more moderate. Professor Breuer told me that as an example of his unconscious bias in his great book on German Orthodoxy, first published in German and then translated to English. He can't get it anymore. I may get it used, but it's not in print. He doesn't have a picture of the Mate Levi, Mordechai Horowitz. And he said, someone asked him, how could you not have a picture? He's a very important figure. And he said to me, basically, that it must be his unconscious bias that he didn't include a picture of Mordechai Horowitz. Because, look, you might not like him because you're in the separatist community, Auschwitz Gemeinde, but he was a very important figure. In fact, he was one of the first opponents of Herzl. You had a whole group there, the Protest Rabbiner, and Mordechai Levi Horowitz, the Mate Levi, signs an anti-Zionist letter against Herzl. Lo and behold, I think it was Haaretz in the 80s, did a whole article, and they found that all these Protest Rabbiners, their descendants, are all living on Admas HaKodesh in Eretz Yisrael. Yes, thank you for pointing it out. Ellie, the so-called Auschwitz Gemeinde, yes, and then you have the Gross Gemeinde, the larger community, which we're going to get into. And Chaim says this Rabbi Bamberger was Rabbi Young Israel of Kingsbridge, and he was Danish and authored The Viking Jews. I never saw that book, The Viking Jews. I have to. We have people who tell us that they got the Torah education at the Breuer's Yeshiva. I have to tell you that the Breuer's Yeshiva today, but today it's irrelevant, it's not important. But in Frankfurt. Even though this was an institution of the separatist community, it did not discriminate. It accepted anyone. It accepted people from all the different communities. And they didn't proselytize and they didn't try to indoctrinate. Yes, it was an institution of the separatist community, but the Breuer's community in Frankfurt accepted people from all over the community. Ah, and I see Naftali is holding up the Viking Jews. And someone privately points out that what Chaim said, however, we know he says that many of the Bamberger descendants were and continue to be active members of Breuer's and married to Breuer's grandchildren. And the fourth generation even are and were the Baalei Kriya in the shul. So it could be that the case of the Nathan Bamberger, it appears, Chaim, that it's more complicated because, look, we're going to see even one in Bamberger's own family, son. Involved with the Auschwitz Gemeinde. And okay. And the final thing that David says, a cute story regarding to Talis as a cheap article of clothing. He once was involved in a negotiation with a secular lawyer who tried to get our clients to settle since the disputed amount was too low to justify all the legal work. The lawyer said, the only Mishnah I know is Shnayim Ochzim B'tava Zeh Merkula Shliv Zeh Merkula Shliv Avani Omer Rabosai Zokula Talis Shliv. Okay. No more questions. Okay, like I said, we're just getting started. We will not meet next week. We will be back, God willing, in 2 weeks. Believe me, it's a good reason why we won't be here in two. I won't be here in 2 weeks, but I look forward to picking it up because this is getting us into really, really fascinating topic, which, as I said, is going to affect every one of us listening because all our communities deal with this. Either we deal with it by we're involved or we're not involved with the others. And it raises fundamental questions of how the Jewish community in America and Europe should be structured today when in a situation when, unfortunately, well, I don't want to say it's unfortunately we have people who are not Torah observant, but it's fortunate that the people who are not Torah observant want to be Jewish and want to be involved. And so how are we supposed to relate to them? And that's we have two Gedol Yisrael who really went at it. So we'll see their arguments and try to come to some maybe understanding. So Rabbi Kelman, I see you're back.
Yeah, just when you were in the middle of the question, so I missed the whole shiur. But okay, I'll listen to it afterward, but just getting the last few minutes of the question. But thank you. Okay. All right, and I see you say you're not going to be talking next week. You'll be back in 2 weeks.
Yeah, next week we're off. Okay. Pick up, God willing, in 2 weeks.
Okay, please, God. Okay, we should hear good news. Okay. All right, so Lila to everybody tomorrow. Rabbi Shulman, of course, continue his class on Kohelet. As ongoing series and all through the week, all our regular shiurim, and we look forward to learning with you and your friends, and we should hear good news. What else can I say? The world is upside down. That's what I say. We live in very world is really nuts, but let's hope that we'll make the world a little bit normal. We can bring light to the world. Anyways, I don't know what to say. Okay, Lila Tov, everybody. Thank you very much.